But there were many snags. The Turks wanted to take over the railway. Mr. Barfield was general manager. And here I criticize him very strongly. He was the man put there by the board to look after the railway's interests. He went into his office, sat down, took a piece of paper, wrote a few words on it, walked back into my father's office and said, "Here you are, Mr. Holton, you are general manager of this railway, I have resigned. I am now going home." And he walked out to his own house, which was the railway company house right by the station, beautiful house, lovely gardens and tennis courts and so on. And he resigned, leaving my father to carry the baby. My father never shirked any responsibility. He had to stay and see the thing out. He saw the Turks when they arrived. They told him that they had decided, now that they were at war with Britain, the British railway would be taken over and it would be run by the Turkish military command, and they would appoint my father to run the railway and the French railway, for there was a French railway also running into the interior of Turkey in a different direction. They would appoint my father to run the two railways, the British and the French railway, from a place called Alashehir, a station some 100 miles away from Smyrna on the French railway. No telephones, no nothing. And my father was supposed to run two railways under instructions from the Turkish military authorities. He didn't hesitate. He said to the Turks, "Gentlemen, you know me. I am a great friend of the Turks, always have been. But unfortunately, our two countries are at war. I cannot obey your instructions, and I will not obey your instructions. If I did so, I would be helping the enemy of my own country, and I should be accountable to my own government in due course for aiding the enemy." They walked out simply saying, "You've heard your instructions and there you are, get on with it." As soon as they left, Father phoned the permanent way superintendent and told him to come round with the motor car on rails, which company owned, and to run us up to Bujao. That's my father and myself. We got home, had a bit of a meal, and father walked down the road to see Mr. Caligari. He was an Austrian, the chief cashier. Very nice man. No loyalty really to Austria whatsoever, much more loyalty to the company and to my father than to here to his country of Austria. I very much doubt that he even could speak German. He and my father then went down to Smyrna on the last train that night, somewhere around about 9 o'clock. Caligaris took his strongroom keys with him. They went into the vaults, took out all the gold coin that was there, some £10,000, put it in bags, got into a horse carriage and drove to the American consulate and deposited these £10,000 in gold with the American consulate. Came back to the station, got a special train, just an engine and carriage, and came back to Bujao. When he got home, he took my mother, my brother Francis, and myself down to the cellar. There was a cellar to the house, of course, and taking diagonal lines from the corners of the cellar where they crossed, we dug a hole some 2 foot deep, and he took out a bag with £200 in gold. He buried it in this hole, filled it up, and just turned around to us and said, now we've got £200 in there. Whatever happens, and they happen to any of us, or all of us, whoever's left this some money there. That was that. Next day, Father did not go up to Alashayir. He has sent word to all the other British employees, telling them that the Turks had ordered all British employees to go to Alashayir, that he himself was not going to obey the order, that under British law that would be aiding the enemy, and he was not going to obey the order. But he left the decision as whether they were to go or not to go to Alashayir to each person individual, to each individual person, their own decision. About 12 o'clock that day, midday, a Turkish officer with the sergeant and some 7 men arrived in Bujao, came to our house, placed my father under house arrest, which meant that no man could come into the house. Father could not leave the house. Ladies or local village women could come to the house, and we could all go and come as we wanted to. But my father was not allowed to leave the house. And that was his first clash, if you like, with the Turkish authorities. This went on for a week or two. But we were very fortunate. The commander-in-chief, Pertev Pasha, was a great Anglophile. And he lived in a very big house that they had taken over from another English family, Mr. Rees. And Mr. Rees was a big ship owner, very wealthy, and had a beautiful house. And this became the commander-in-chief's headquarters. So nearly every night, my brother Francis and I, after dark, we just go across to the Rees's house and try and see Pertev Pasha, see whether he could do anything about A, getting father free from this house arrest, and B, getting us permits to leave the country. We never saw Pertev Pasha himself, but we invariably saw his ADC, and we received every courtesy and consideration. And in due course, we were informed that the guards were to be taken away from the house, and that father was free. Furthermore, Betef Pasha got a permit. How he did it, I don't know, because Constantinople would have been furious. He got a permit for my father, mother, and myself. I was 17. See, I was not of military age. My brother Francis was of military age, so he couldn't leave the country. But mother and father and I, Mr. and Mrs. Barfield, their daughter and her husband, and he was the chief engineer, and Mr. Elliot, the locomotive superintendent, and his wife and daughter, we were all permitted to leave the country. That was more easy to talk about than to carry out, because the Gulf of Smyrna comes, it's an enormous big gulf, but it comes to a very narrow entrance. And there the Turks had sunk two big cargo ships to block the entrance into the Gulf of Smyrna. So nothing could leave that way. So my father and I went down to the offices of one of the small Greek shipping companies. And one of them said that they had a very small ship leaving little port of Vurla, some 40 miles from Smyrna, in a couple of days' time. So there and then, father took the whole ship. He chartered the ship for all of us, the Barfields, the Elliots, and ourselves, to take us to Piraeus. I forget what that cost, but of course we had the £200 which had been sunk down there, and I don't know whether there was any other money available, but anyhow, this was arranged. And lo and behold, one fine midday, four carriages, each loaded up with, I say, the Barfields and the Elliots and ourselves, left Smyrna for Vurla. And Pertev Pasha had even given us a Turkish military escort, a sentry with fixed bayonet sitting with the driver, the coachman. And we drove down to Vurla, where there's this little Greek ship waiting. We got to the ship and sailed that evening. And it was only after we'd got out of Turkish waters and were on the way to Piraeus that Mr. Barfield and father were talking, and they both turned out to us all and said, well, we're lucky, because both Mr. Houghton and Mr. Barfield have been ordered to appear before court-martial in a couple of days' time. So we only got out of the skin of our teeth. Well, once in Athens, we got onto an ordinary ship to Brindisi, and from there by train to Italy, France, and back to England, where we arrived on Christmas Eve, 1914. The only events that I can remember on our way home were a stop in Milan, where we had a chance to see the cathedral. And I suppose one of the most wonderful cathedrals I had ever seen up to that time of my young life. That left quite an impression. The other thing that struck me was going through Switzerland. We got on the Swiss frontier more or less at sunset. The train skirted Lago Maggiore, and the view of the lake and Isola Bella right in the center of it, with surrounding mountains covered in snow, the sun setting, a brilliant, wonderful sunset, all reflected on the snow, and the whole lot of that then reflected back in the lake with the little island, Isola Bella, showing up just like a jewel. The other thing I remember was going through France, and some of our stopping places on the way, British soldiers wearing sheepskin coats coming up to the train, and everybody in the train throwing them out cigarettes and chocolate, and the soldiers filling up their Dixies with boiling water from the engine. That, I think, is the last thing that I remember of that trip home. And as I said before, we got home on Christmas Eve, 1914. We stayed with our cousins, the Hawkses, for a day or two, and then found furnished rooms at Ilford, where we stayed for quite a time. I suppose about a year. Father, in the meantime, was receiving from the railway half pay. This lasted for 6 months, after which he went on to quarter pay, and for another 6 months. And that was the end of his financial income. What he had in England in the way of money, I don't know. But I know that he told me I should look for a job, and I did, and I found a job with a French manufacturer's agent in London Wall. He sold hardware, chiefly razors, kitchen knives and so on, shaving brushes, chain burnishers, and other hardware from samples sent by the French manufacturers. And he only wanted one clerk with a knowledge of French. I seemed to meet his requirements, and I started work there with a salary of 17 shillings and sixpence a week, which after a couple of weeks he put up to 20 shillings a week. I stayed with him for about a year, after which I went to the Board of Trade, the exhibitions branch, which had now been converted into an inter-allied supplies commission, on which all the allies, Belgian, French, and I believe Italians as well, had representatives. And every time any of our allies wanted any goods for war purposes from our country, they had to apply to this commission. And if the company supplying the goods was supplying the Admiralty or the War Office and was up to date with their deliveries, then a permit was given for them to export to France or Belgium. If, however, they were not up to date with their deliveries, the permit would not be given until they had met the requirements of the War Office, Ministry of Munitions, or the Navy. And I stayed with them for about a year, by which time I had reached the minimum age for entry into the army, which I was very keen to enter. And my parents had warned me that if I tried to join before I was old enough, they would have me back again. And father and mother raised no objection to my joining the army, provided I was of the right military age. They contended that one brother out in Turkey, mother, two brothers, John and Alfred, being already in the army, we were doing our bit, and it was not for me to join before my time. But they had no objection to my joining as soon as I was of military age, and I joined up on my 18th birthday. No, sorry, on my 19th birthday. I joined the Essex Yeomanry, because John was already in the Essex Yeomanry out in France. Alfred was with the Royal Naval Division in the Dardanelles. Here, I think I should digress from the activities of myself and my two brothers and go back to what father was doing. All this time, father had been doing nothing. But of course, I suppose he must have been getting short of cash. He never discussed money matters with us, with me anyway. And he suddenly had a brainwave. He didn't want to try and get a job for the sake of making money only. He also wanted to do something that would be helping the war effort. So he suddenly thought of Churchill. And he wrote to Churchill, reminded him of their previous meeting out in Smyrna, telling him of his qualifications as an experienced accountant and so on, and asking him whether some sort of a job could be found for him which would help the war effort. He had no reply from Churchill, but he had a letter from one of the heads of the Ministry of Munitions, to whom Winston had passed my father's letter. He was asked to go up and see them at the Hotel Metropole in Northumberland Avenue, and he was offered a job, not a frightfully well-paid job. I think it was about $250 a year, but it would keep the wolf from the door, and it was a job to do with the war, and father felt that that was good enough, and he took it. and he stayed with them right to the end of the war. Now, I don't think there was anything else that happened as far as father's concerned or mother. Mother did help in services canteens and things like that. So you see, the whole family, except Francis, who was out in Turkey, the whole family was engaged in some way or another in helping the war along. Now back to myself. I went down to the Essex Yeomanry. I joined the 3rd Battalion in Aldershot. And I must say, although my stay with them was rather short-lived, I did enjoy the experience tremendously. I was a private, I had a horse, and I had been on the back of a horse once or twice, donkeys many, many a time. So that when I joined up and had a horse to look after and a horse to ride, I wasn't exactly quite as much of a greenhorn as other new recruits that came along. My life in the Essex Yeomanry was not very eventful, just one or two little amusing bits. The first day I went on parade, the Sergeant Major called out the names and then said, anybody whose name I haven't called out, step forward. I stepped forward one pace and said, hello, and where you come from? And I said, oh, I've come rather nonplussed, and I didn't quite know what to say. And I said, oh, I've come from Turkey. So he said, what? You bloody Turk? Of course, that was that. My name after that in the Essex Yeomanry was Turkey. I was known by the nickname of Turkey by all my pals. The next little amusing thing was when I first got onto a horse. My first riding school effort. There were several other recruits there, and I was on the horse, and in the first ride is the beginner's class, the corporal looked at me and said, hello, where you come from? So I said, I've only just arrived, I'm a recruit. So he looked at me and said, where have you learnt your riding? I said, I haven't learnt any riding. He said, don't talk to me like that. When I say you've been on a horse before, you've been on a horse before. Where have you been on a horse before? So I sort of looked at him, I said, not much horse riding, but I've done an awful lot of donkey riding out in Turkey. Of course, the whole crowd laughed, and he laughed, and that was that. But I did get on well. I was a keen young soldier, kept myself fairly smart, took part in all the activities, particularly in football. And there I think I rather shone, especially after our squadron played another squadron. And half-time we were down rather badly, 3-love against us or something like that. Chiefly because everybody was wrongly placed. The sergeant was acting as our non-playing captain, and he just shoved the chaps in different places without knowing anything at all about how they played. And at half-time I went up to the sergeant. I said, look, sergeant, all this team is wrong, completely wrongly placed. Can I switch them round a bit? He said, well, you're doing so damn badly, you do jolly well do what you like. He said, I don't care damn what you do, but you can't do worse than you're doing now. So I switched them round. I sort of appointed myself captain, switched the team round. And the result was that from a half-time, three love score against us, we beat the opposing side 5-3. We scored five times in the second half. Of course, that sort of made my reputation. And the next thing I knew that I was picked to play for the whole battalion. And later I was picked to play for the shot command.
I'll now stop here and get on to the next cassette.